The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com. For more than a decade, he's been Philadelphia's destination for news, opinion, and passion.
I am a devoted listener every day, 3 hours, kids in the car, the whole thing.
Hey, good morning, Chris. Always love your show.
I just love your show. Just love it.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990 The Answer and 990theanswer.com.
Mild. They can't stop using the word mild. Have you noticed that? Omicron is mild. What are you afraid of? Are you afraid? Is the question. They tried yesterday to convince you 800,000 dead. Dun, dun, dun. How long are we going to use that number? When are we going to come off that number? We're just going to continue to add to that tally. The U.S. death toll from COVID-19 topped 800,000 Tuesday, a once unimaginable figure. Figure seen as doubly tragic, given that more than 200,000 of those lives were lost after what? After Joe Biden became president. Is what they meant to say, but instead Politico wrote after a vaccine became available. It is a great question. Why are more people dying? Why did we reach 800,000 deaths from COVID yesterday? Why did that happen? I really would like to ask that question of everyone. Do you know the answer, Fast Eddie?
Well, yes. I mean, the vaccine does not prevent you from dying either.
That's correct, but also I ask it rhetorically because I would submit to you that a lot of those people didn't have to die if what?
There was access to therapeutics.
That's exactly right. Do you know the number of messages that I'm still receiving from people asking me how do I get monoclonal antibody treatment? How do I get it? And I can't speak for New Jersey, and I can't speak for Delaware. I know we've heard from some people specific to Delaware. I haven't heard anybody talk about it in New Jersey, but I know that in Pennsylvania, do you know the number of Pennsylvanians that ask me, where can I find monoclonal antibody treatment? I bet you I get it daily since Christine and I got monoclonal antibody treatment back in October. And here's my answer. You can't get it easily. And I want to ask, and this is a sincere question, too, and I know it's a bit, maybe we won't like the answer, but let me ask you this, Fast Eddie. Why do you think it is so difficult to get monoclonal antibody treatment in Pennsylvania?
I think because, one, nobody really knows where to get it. It's not being advertised anywhere.
That's right. And why do you think that is exactly? I don't have an answer, by the way. I'm not looking for an answer. I'm rhetorically asking, why is it so hard for people to find therapeutics?
I think in the medical community, it's the government is telling them it's either the shot or nothing, and that's it.
Bingo. That's correct. There are a scary number of people in medicine who don't even seem to know about them or don't seem to understand what they do or don't seem to understand how people can obtain them. Or seem to think they're last-ditch efforts. And I want to know why that is. I would love for someone in nursing, maybe a doctor who listens to the show, and I hear from you on occasion, and I don't mean to call all of you out because I know some of you are fantastic on this issue. I want to know why we're treating monoclonal antibodies and therapeutics still at this hour. We're treating them like some kind of underground railroad. You know, I think, was it Pfizer or I don't remember which anymore. There are a couple of different. Merck, I know, came out with a pill. They were very excited about this COVID pill, which Scott Gottlieb was saying over the weekend and again yesterday that this is 90% effective or something in treating COVID if you get it. It's a pharmaceutically created therapeutic. Now, the I forget the name of the company now. Got all these pharmaceutical companies coursing through my head, and I don't remember which. Created the monoclonals that President Trump had.
Regeneron.
Thank you. I get that confused with remdesivir. Regeneron. Those two words, just they're the same word to me, and I can't. Okay. Remdesivir is also a therapeutic, which they now say isn't as effective. But the Regeneron company created these monoclonals that former President Trump had when he got COVID. It's what Christine and I were administered. And I have to tell you that at this hour, when people reach out to me from all over the country, because people listen to me talk about it on the podcast, so I haven't just mentioned it here on the show, and I think I've told you I do a second show in Kansas City. And when I talk about it, I am shocked. And I talk about it more often probably than you care to hear me talk about it, only because it depresses me the number of people that don't understand it. They've never heard of it. They don't know how to get it. People reach out to me and they say, Chris, how do you? And I feel stupid because I'm not a doctor and I don't have an answer for you as to why you're not being told by your medical professional about it. I don't have an answer. Well, how do I find it? How did you get yours? I said, no, how I got mine is not relevant to you because you live in a different area. And so you're not going to be able to have the same experience I had. I'm not keeping it a secret. It's just that what I went through to get mine is not going to be what you're going to experience, particularly if you're in Pennsylvania. You've got to go through some intermediary to even get the damn thing in Pennsylvania. I'm not being coy about telling you how I got mine. It's just that I didn't have to do that way. I was out of state when I got mine. And it was a simple pick up the phone and call a number and make an appointment. There was no intermediary. There was no doctor. There was nothing. I picked up the phone. I called a number. They said, here's your appointment time. A day later, I was driven to the appointment. I was injected with the thing. I felt better in 24 hours. It was that easy. There was nothing more to it than that. And so I told this story when I returned from feeling pretty sick with COVID after a week, and I started getting the calls, and I'm still getting the calls and emails. Please tell me, how do I get this therapeutic? And so I see this number, 800,000 dead yesterday, and it makes me livid because I know that if, in fact, and by the way, we all know how these are counted now. You know, you get run over by a reindeer. Grandma gets run over by the reindeer, and then she's found to be COVID positive with no symptoms. She's ruled a COVID death, not a reindeer death. They've been playing this game now for a couple of years. We know this from our coroner friends here in Pennsylvania. So I'm not sure I even trust the number 800,000 dead from COVID, but setting that aside for a minute, if true that in fact people are catching COVID and dying, it doesn't have to happen. It didn't have to happen. COVID is no longer deadly. COVID is no longer deadly. COVID was really never deadly. Ooh, there's something that's risky to say. COVID was really never deadly. 800,000 dead. How can you say that? Oh, no. I'm not saying that sick, weak, elderly people or immunocompromised people aren't vulnerable to something killing them, but the flu would have if COVID hadn't. Otherwise, healthy people with immune systems are not going to be killed by COVID. COVID isn't deadly. COVID was never statistically deadly when we didn't understand what it was and there was no shot and there were no therapeutics. COVID was not statistically deadly. Does everyone understand that? I know you do, but I wonder how often do we, because you understand that all of this lockdown, masking, all of these mandates, the reason people adhere to them, the reason people have this feverish, cultish excitement about you getting the shot and you obeying and you showing your papers, you understand how that happens? It can't happen unless a sizable chunk of the population is afraid. What are they afraid of? Ultimately, they're afraid of their mortality. The only way people are willing to completely shelve their liberties and freedoms and start turning on fellow Americans is if they think they are in some kind of grave mortal danger. It's the only way it works. And it's working. And that's what's happened. And still at this hour, there's a sizable chunk of this population, and I blame medicine. That's right. I said it. I'll say it again. I blame doctors and I blame nurses. I just do. Not all of you, but I blame a lot of you for refusing to tell the truth about what this disease is. It is a virus. It is a virus that most people catch and most people live through. And only the sickest and only the most immunocompromised are sent to the hospital. And when that happens, most of the time, those people were already on a fast track to bad stuff anyway. COVID kind of finished them off. And even at that, I say to medicine broadly, I don't mean anyone in particular, so I hope no one in this audience takes offense. I assume if you're in this audience, I'm not talking to you, okay? But I blame medicine in general for being so completely dishonest about this virus and the way it's treated and the therapeutics that have been available to people. And when they trot out this number, 800,000, number one, I don't believe the number. Number two, even if true, it doesn't have to be. And number three, at this hour, no one should be dying from COVID. No one. And no one should be motivated to do anything on behalf of COVID out of fear of death. No one should be afraid of dying. And yet there still are people who are afraid. Well, this gets into more of a theological discussion than anything else at this point. If you're afraid of death, that's, again, something I strongly encourage you to go seek some theological counsel. I think you need to get right with something bigger than yourself if you're that terrified, you're that consumed with dying. But setting that aside for a minute, you're afraid COVID's going to kill you? That's not a mentally well position to take. Let me say, adult time, okay? Going to adult with you here. You being scared of dying from COVID is not a mature adult thing to think.
I agree.
Assuming you're well. Now, again, I'm making some assumptions here. Assuming you are well. If you are at high risk of certain things and you, in counsel with your doctor, determine you're a risk, you know, you're ticking time bomb, you know, I don't know if it's heart, if it's cancer, if you're battling some kind of illness, different story. But if all things being equal, you're trucking along just fine and you get COVID, COVID is not going to kill you. As a statistical matter, it's not. And furthermore, you shouldn't even get to a place where you need to see a hospital with COVID. More to the point, you shouldn't even be hospitalized with it. And why? I go back to the beginning. Because there are therapeutics online right now and available right now. And there were before Merck and Pfizer made COVID pills. There were workable therapeutics. And I know a lot of you in this audience have talked about hydroxychloroquine. And I know a lot of you have talked about ivermectin. I know. I haven't had an experience with it, so I can't speak to it directly. All I can speak to you about is what I know. And I've certainly heard Joe Rogan and many other people talk about their successes with ivermectin. I'm not discounting it. What I'm telling you is monoclonal antibodies worked for my wife and me and took two very sick people and turned to, I say very sick. Alex has kind of disabused me of saying very sick even. To me, I felt miserable. Sickest I've ever felt. So sick I was going to be hospitalized? No. My wife had a pretty wicked cough that we started to think might warrant visiting an urgent care or something. These monoclonals shut it all down in 24 hours, like a switch. And the only reason I knew about it is because we'd been doing shows talking about it really aggressively, ironically, the week before she and I caught it. So I knew to look into it. And it took me some digging. And through some digging, I found a number that I was able to call, not here in Pennsylvania. And then I started looking into this for Pennsylvania. And I was shocked to find out that, you know, when people are given monoclonals. So again, my experience was I catch it. I feel rotten. I call. I get the injection within days of being diagnosed and feeling bad. And within 24 hours of getting the injection with the monoclonals, I feel much, much better. And in a few more days, I am able to return to the air. Still don't feel great, but I'm a lot better than I was the week that I had to take off that just knocked me out. Long, painful week. Won't lie. Didn't feel great the second week, but a lot better. Thanks to monoclonals. But when I start digging around in Pennsylvania, for instance, about this, I find that the people that I knew that already had it, you know when they were given it? When they were in the hospital. The first person that I knew in Pennsylvania that had COVID and got so sick she had to go to the hospital with it, That was when they said, all right, well, I guess we'll try the monoclonals. And she had great positive experience with it. So when I researched it and I got it for my wife and me and we had great experience with it, I became an evangelist about it. I came to the air. I told you about it. I've encouraged you for weeks and weeks since then. Look into how to get it. Look into how to find it. And I have had people, and I'm not kidding you, weekly at least, Fast Eddie, since I had COVID back in October, at least weekly, I get mail from around the country. How did you get your monoclonals? And I say, it depends on where you live. And I think people think I'm being coy about it. I'm not being coy about it. I'm telling you that in Pennsylvania, good luck unless you've got a doctor telling you to go get it. And if you go to that doctor and you say, hey, I'd like to know, how do I get monoclonal antibody treatment? Your doctor may or may not say, oh, I'm not. No, you can't get. No, I'm no. Your doctor may say, okay, great. We'll send you and get you them. Or your doctor may say, I monoclonal, huh, now? Huh? What's monoclonal? First of all, if you have a doctor that goes, what's monoclonal antibodies? Get a new doctor. Get a new doctor if they don't know what this is. Number two, get a new doctor if your doctor goes, oh, no, we only give that to the very, very sick and hospitalized. You don't need that. Get a new doctor. And the numbers of you that have reached out to me and told me that that has been your doctor's response, or either I don't know what it is, I don't know how you can get it, or, oh, we only give that to very sick people in the hospital. No, you can't. Take this pill and go home. I am shocked at the number of people that are getting that kind of treatment by people who are supposedly medical professionals. So there are still too many people in our midst. What I'm saying is that, one, are scared to death of this virus. They live in terror of it. Number two, they live in this terror that is that they will die if they get it. So they're not only afraid of the virus, they're afraid of their own mortality. And number three, they have medical professionals that they consult with that tell them, oh, no, no, I don't know what that lunatic on the radio has been telling you, but you can't have therapeutics, even if you get it, or if you have it now. No, 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 you can't have therapeutic. You know, this thing is starting to spread. It's starting to bubble up and pop in Pennsylvania and in this region in the southeast of Pennsylvania quite a bit. And I'm starting to hear from more people that are catching it and more people that are saying, hey, I remember you doing the show about monoclonals. How do you get it? And I say, this is, it could be complicated depending on where you live. Well, what do you mean? You got it. I said, I know. And what I did was not what you're going to have to do, particularly if you live in Pennsylvania. And again, I don't know. I really don't know what it is in New Jersey. But the reason I'm doing this is twofold. The embrace of a mandate, the embrace of the general public producing papers that we all injected ourselves with a medicine that doesn't even work. I know the working theory is now that it was never about a vaccine keeping you from getting sick. Now it's about not letting you get very sick. So in essence, it's a therapeutic. In other words, we're now talking about the shot like I'm talking about monoclonals. So all things being equal, you catch COVID having injected the vaccine, air quotes, shot, or you catch COVID and you go treat yourself with an injection of monoclonal antibodies. Your pick. But they're both, let's just be honest, at this point, therapeutics. So,
right.
What do you choose? Take a shot and wait to get not as sick, or wait to get sick, take the monoclonal antibodies, for instance, or whatever therapeutic you'd like to take, and fight off the effects of the COVID you caught. I mean, you pick, but let's be honest, showing paperwork that we did one and virtually being unable to find the other, think of that. Think of where we've come. One, I have to produce papers to people to participate in polite society. The other one, I have to beg on bended knee people in the medical community to give to me. Hello?
Right. Plus, look at the timeline. I mean, Ron DeSantis was campaigning, saying early treatment saves lives, getting monoclonals, going around Florida. Then the federal government comes after him and says, well, you're taking all the monoclonals. We need to distribute these evenly. What happened to that fight?
That's exactly right. Ron DeSantis was opening these things up all over the state of Florida. Now, I know it is being reported that monoclonals and these therapeutics aren't as effective against Omicron, but neither is the shot. However, Omicron is also not severe. Every study that has been done so far that we know about this new strain says it's not a severe virus. But even if you don't believe in monoclonals, and even if you're having a hard time finding it, well, huzzah, huzzah, Big Pharma has created a couple of new pills that are out on the market, and they're supposedly 90% effective in combating symptoms if you get COVID. The point is, whether you go the pharmacological route, whether you go the ivermectin hydroxy route, I mean, all of it's pharmacology, I understand, but I'm just saying whether you go the approved, you know, Big Pharma, Pfizer just made a new pill and it makes you feel good because it's Pfizer, or if you can find somebody to give you monoclonal antibodies, and I say if because that's still apparently still hard, I guess, if you live in Pennsylvania, or if you get your hands on hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, I don't know, but any or all of those things have been reported in many people, if not most people, to work very effectively in keeping COVID at bay. I mean, a guy reached out to me yesterday and he said, Chris, you know, I listened to you. I'm a healthy young guy. I got COVID. I got pretty sick. I actually ended up going to the hospital. I wish I'd listened to you about monoclonal antibodies. I wished I'd gone to get it, but I thought I could tough it out on my own. I don't recommend that. I don't recommend you be arrogant about COVID, okay? And I am not. I respect it. I don't recommend anybody be arrogant about this thing. If you get it, it can really knock you for a loop. I don't think it's going to kill you, most likely, unless there's something about you. And again, I'm not your doctor, so I can't know everything going on inside. But I'm saying if you're an otherwise healthy person, I still don't think it's going to kill you. I think you're going to feel pretty miserable on balance. Sometimes you won't, but you may. And if you feel like my wife and I felt, I'm telling you, I want you to get your hands on monoclonal antibodies because it will change the course of this virus for you and the length of time you will suffer. And it will keep your symptoms from getting exacerbated. I want that for you. And I should think, I'm a nobody. I'm a stupid talk show host. I'm not a doctor. I don't know anything about this. I should think that everyone in medicine would want this for their patients. I should think every doctor with an earshot of my voice today would be telling their patients, hey, I understand you're concerned about COVID. Or, hey, I'm sorry to hear you have COVID. Here's how we'll tackle that. Or here's what you need to know if that should happen. Call me right away and we'll do X. Here's our game plan. That's still, 2 years into this thing, it's still not happening. People are still living in terror they might catch this, or people are just now catching this, and they're scared. It's scaring them, and there is no reason to be scared of this anymore. And yet people are. And they are because media says 800,000 dead. That doesn't mean 800,000 people died yesterday. It also doesn't mean of those 800,000 people, they're all counted equally. It also doesn't mean we understand anything about those 800,000 people and what they might have been battling earlier. And again, I encourage you to go and look at totals of numbers of deaths in a calendar year in this country and what people die of. We've done that before on the show. It's worth some perspective. 800,000 sounds like a huge number. It's a big number. But when taken over the span of 2 years and considering who dies of what over the span of 2 years in this country, we need perspective, not panic, folks. And if you have not had COVID and you're worried about COVID, you need to not be for a couple of different reasons. One, I'll leave off the air because, again, it's, I think, more spiritual and theological, and I hope you'll go to your house of worship soon and talk with a spiritual advisor about that fear that you live with, if that's you, if you're just crippled with fear of your own mortality. But number two, from a scientific perspective, it doesn't need to be. COVID is not a death sentence. And when it comes to your kids, and let me just talk to you about this quickly too, you also need somebody who's in a position of responsibility to tell you, if you're worried about your children dying from COVID, you really need to knock that off. There is nothing about this disease, this virus, from the beginning that ever warranted panic over children and treating our children like lab experiments. None. So if you have people chirping in your ear about your kid and COVID, you tell them to shut right up. There is nothing about your children that are in. If you're, again, if your children are healthy, I mean, the only caveat being is if you're already a very sick or compromised person, I can't know that. But if you're an otherwise healthy person and if you're an otherwise healthy child, there is zero reason to be injecting your kids with anything. No one's talking to us this way. I'm not saying anything profound, but who are you hearing talk to you like this in the general media? I don't mean guests that we have like Alex Berenson or Daniel Horowitz. I know they are. They're doing far more intensive scientific work than me. I just wonder who's like the average person in your life saying to you, this isn't a thing. This is not what you're being told it is. This is not scary. It's not going to kill you. It's certainly not going to kill your kids. And if you catch it, there's plenty of ways to treat it. And by the way, there is no reason if you don't want to take this shot. There's no reason you have to, because we can manage it now if you've decided you'd rather just roll the dice and risk catching it. Because either way, apparently, that's what we're dealing with at this point. Get the shot and maybe not get as sick, or catch COVID, and when you do, get some therapeutics that will keep you from getting not as sick. So six one, half dozen of the other. Where are the adults? Where's the honesty in our medicine? Is your neighborhood doctor, is your family doctor talking to you this way? If he or she is not, I would strongly suggest researching new medical care. If COVID is on your mind and really consuming you still. Just some friendly advice. Of course, I'm not a doctor. I'm a talk show host. And you should treat my counsel accordingly. Telephone number 610-850-0990. 610-850-0990. We're online at 990theanswer.com. I really get mad when people tell me they were in the hospital and they couldn't get monoclonals. That really makes me mad. That's when I get the most mad. I have yet to hear a cogent response from anyone in medicine who just flatly refuses to give people monoclonal antibody treatments. And in some cases, I've heard from people who have lost loved ones. And medicine doctors have still said, we're not going to. Why wouldn't, if somebody's truly dying, why would you not just throw everything but the kitchen sink at them at that point? Why wouldn't you?
It's insidious.
It really is.
Christmas is the time of year for being with the ones we love.
Merry Christmas.
Sharing so much.
It is a fantastic time of year. Telephone number 610-850-0990. Head to the phones. Alan's in Ridley Park, I believe. Alan, I'm sure glad you called. Philadelphia's AM 990. The answer, good morning.
Good morning, Chris. Merry Christmas and healthy and happy New Year to you and your family.
Likewise, sir. Thank you.
You're welcome. So,
what's on your mind today?
Well, I survived COVID. I found out that I had COVID. I was asymptomatic. I got a T-cell test over the summer. And my best friend, number one, won't come near me. He's vaccinated because I'm not vaccinated.
Let me explore that for a minute. Your friend who's vaccinated is afraid of you because you've not had the shot.
Oh, yeah. He told my neighbor that just tell him to go get the jab.
And but what does he think will happen?
Him and his wife, and their daughter, they're afraid that they're going to get COVID and die. They're just like you're talking about, earlier on the show this morning.
Isn't that sad?
They're scared to death. It is sad. When this thing started, I was never in fear of this. But with all this being said, and then the city stuff, I wanted to bring up that I'm also a season ticket holder to the Flyers, and we. Last night I was at the game and my partner and I, who I split our season tickets with, went up to talk to our Flyers rep and ask them what the outcome's going to be with this new Band-Aid in the city for showing your vaccination card. Neither one of us are vaccinated. And he shared with us that right now we will not get our money refunded, but they're researching it.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa, so you bought Flyer season tickets already, so you've already put out the money, and they're saying with this vaccine mandate kicking in January 3rd, where you got to produce paperwork if you want to walk into the Wells Fargo Center, you don't have the shot, you don't intend to, so you said, okay, if we don't, will we get our money back? And they told you right now, no, we have no plans to give season ticket buyers their money back if they don't have the paperwork.
That's the plan as of yesterday. Now, he said it's early, we're negotiating, but to hear that last night was kind of like mind-blowing. And through all of this, they never speak about people that are not vaccinated but that have had COVID, like you, like me. There's nothing out there for people like us. We're like excluded from everything, from any testing, anything. It's just sad. It's just sad that we've come to this.
How do you think this ends? I mean, do you think this ends with the Flyers in perpetuity, the Wells Fargo Center, Philadelphia in perpetuity, asking you to, produce papers? Do you think that day ends and you'll just wait it out? What do you think as a fan?
As a fan, why not start up right now? I mean, we're down there last night with 19,000 people. Nobody's wearing masks. I mean, what happens after the first of the year? Does COVID come out of the woodwork and infect people that aren't wearing masks? I just don't understand any of this. I'm lost for words. I don't get it.
You're not alone, Alan. I sure thank you for calling. I wish you a Merry Christmas, my friend. I'm sorry you're dealing with that. I hope, if at nothing else, at the very least, you get your money back. But what a sad thing. Longtime Flyers fans are being treated that way. Isn't that sad?
The group that I went to the partial season tickets on the Sixers with through college, like that's what we did in college. We were thinking about doing it again. We're meeting on Tuesday all to talk about it. Now, I mean, what the hell? That's I'm not doing that now.
I want to believe that the late Ed Snyder is rolling in his grave over something like this. I want to believe that's true. I only knew him professionally. I knew his politics a little bit, and I think if I understood his politics, this is nothing that he would ever embrace or endorse, although he probably wouldn't have any choice given that the Flyers and the Wells Fargo Center reside in Philadelphia. It's lunacy. George is next. George is our hospital administrator friend who called the show a few weeks ago with some great perspective. He travels around the country to different hospitals as an administrator with a large group. And so, George, good morning. Welcome back to the show. Loved your perspective and visit the last time. What's going on?
Yeah, good morning, Chris. I hope you are a godsend to the listening communities that you serve with that voice of yours. So I wanted to give your listeners this morning some perspective and validity to your comments. Again, out in Texas.
May I interrupt you before we start and ask? Yeah. Because I was harsh. I said I didn't castigate all of medicine. I wanted to be clear that I don't mean this of every doctor and every nurse and every person practicing medicine, but far too many still seem woefully either ill-equipped or ill-informed over how to treat this virus, other than just talk about the shot. Is that fair or unfair?
Well, I don't know. I think it's more political. I would implore your listeners, especially in Pennsylvania, to contact the local politicians, state, local, and advocate for therapies. I had a friend who was sick, and his family was sick there in Pennsylvania. He called me, Chris, what can I do? Where can I go? And man, I'm telling you, trying to find sites that are providing therapeutics is a needle in a haystack in Pennsylvania.
It's crazy. George, why is that happening? Why?
Politics, Chris. That's the only answer that I have. It's politics. The threat of licensing, the threats of reimbursement from the government if you don't comply with their crazy mandates and and ideas. That's what's causing, I believe, these issues with regard to healthcare providers. Their licenses are threatened. They're threatened to be outed as non-compliant with government mandates. So, yeah, I think Pennsylvania is one of those states. Like I said, it's a needle in a haystack trying to find where you can get therapeutics.
So I don't mean to belabor this, but I want to tell you about both my experience and a similar experience that my sister-in-law had in the Chicago area, because she got sick with COVID about the same time my wife and I did. And none of us were in Pennsylvania with it at the time. So we were able to, in my wife and my case, we were back in Missouri, and I was able to call a number in Missouri, just call a number that the state provided. And they said, okay, what's going on? I told them, they asked me a couple of questions. They said, okay, you're scheduled for the infusion tomorrow at this and such, go here. And there was no doctor, there's no intermediary. I called directly, and it was fully funded by, you know, the taxpayers, of course, but it was a state run thing. And the state followed up similarly. My sister-in-law in the Chicagoland area, she wanted to know, she got sick, how do I get it? I got online for her and looked around. There was like a pop-up freestanding. Yeah. She had to pay out of pocket for it. But in Illinois, she was able to drive to this place where they were administering them on their own, is my point. And so there's two states, yeah. Illinois and Missouri, for instance. And I know Florida is the case. You're able to just call someone up and go get it. In Pennsylvania, there's this bizarre, you got to go genuflect to your doctor who may or may not let you, or may tell you, oh, no, that's only in case you're hospitalized. And it's so weird, George.
Yeah, Chris, and the story I told Fast Eddie, you know, I have an employee out here in Texas, extremely obese. Morbidly obese, as you're one of the commercials I just heard on your station. Her sister, she watched her sister die 2.5 months ago from COVID. She wound up catching it and went to her physician, tested positive. She was nervous, concerned, scared, didn't know what to do. And I finally, you know, in talking with her, I said, hey, you need to get monoclonal antibodies. And out here in Texas, they have, you know, opportunities anywhere in the state to get monoclonal antibodies. She wound up getting monoclonal antibodies on a Friday, late Friday. Saturday, she was still feeling kind of lousy. By Sunday, I called her. She was a different person. She's back to work. She was back to work this past Monday.
You believe strictly and only it is politics that won't allow a doctor in Pennsylvania to just simply say to his or her patient, here's monoclonals, or here's how to go get it. Or more to the point, why aren't there just freestanding facilities administering monoclonals in Pennsylvania without the use or need of a doctor?
Tom Wolf.
The Republican-run Commonwealth, you mean, out of Harrisburg.
Yes, right. Uh-huh. Yeah, you had that... Republican on the other day. I'm like, come on, man, you got to get tough.
You know, I don't even think about asking about this, and I should. We've had a number of reps and senators on, and I haven't broached this subject. I should. I don't know why I haven't. Shame on me for not. Harrisburg could allow it if they wanted to. But here's the other thing. It also means they're not allowing it. Here's what's more insidious. There's something very specifically not allowing it. Otherwise, the free market would. Right, it would explode just like it has in other places of the country, and there would be people charging for the monoclonals on their own in a pop-up clinic, right?
Correct, Chris, but you have to understand the federal government is controlling the distribution of the monoclonals. They're allocating, they're providing allocations on a state-by-state basis. So that there's still a control aspect that makes it difficult unless you're Ron DeSantis and starts negotiating directly with companies that provide monoclonal. It's the allocation piece that's part of it. That's a federal government allocation strategy that they have. But then you get to your local states, the individual states, and politics matters. Elections have consequences, in my opinion.
And just let's put a bow on this, since you work closely as an administrator with hospitals, a lot of hospitals. We can officially shelve this notion that COVID is overrunning our hospitals. That's not a thing anymore, is it really? Or am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong. That's correct. It's not overrunning hospitals. Sure, we have patients, and there's a spike. As I said on the last call, December, January, we had the same thing when we had no vaccines. We had a spike. Chris, the issue, and I spoke to it the last time, is the staffing and the nurses. The nurses, a lot of them have retired.
Well, in fact, there was a story this week. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Monday, I had a story that states are calling out the National Guard to serve as nurses.
Yes.
Now. It's getting that depleted. Yeah.
Yes. And it's really because nurses can leave our hospitals and go and make four times their salary than what they can make, at our hospitals as a traveling nurse. And, so that makes it much more attractive for them. And like I said, a lot of retirements.
Yeah. George, it's been a pleasure to catch up. I hope you'll stay in touch. We learn a lot when we have these conversations. Thank you so much.
Great. Take care. Bye-bye.
Merry Christmas. That's George, a hospital administrator who's down in Texas, listens online, has given us a lot of great perspective. Oh, it makes me so mad when I think that there are people that are almost literally driving up and getting therapeutics when they catch COVID. In states like Florida, or as I mentioned, Illinois even, or Missouri. But in Pennsylvania, you've got to go, genuflect, go through this Mother May I business. Oh, it makes me so angry. And people are dying and getting sick, and very sick, and unnecessarily, because of it. Boy, if you didn't know any better, you'd have to conclude that all around you is a lot of gaslighting with fear and ignorance about a lot of things that aren't real to keep you from talking about the things that are real. Peter Navarro.
This next. Is WNTP, Philadelphia's AM 990. The Answer, a Salem Media Group station on the NASDAQ at SALM. For more than a decade, he's been Philadelphia's destination for news, opinion, and passion.
Hey, love you, man. You're all we got in Philadelphia.
Hi, Chris. I love your show.
I love your show. And I have to say my wife, who's a Democrat, also loves your show.
Good morning, Chris. Always enjoy your show.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer, and 990theanswer.com.
He's appointment listening every time we have him on. So glad to have him back. And this is a great Christmas gift, by the way. If you're looking for a voracious reader's gift and you don't know what to buy, In Trump Time, a Journal of America's Plague Year, written by the great Peter Navarro, who's back with us. He's actually become quite a broadcaster, too. He spends a lot of time on his own podcast, and he's been on lots of different radio shows talking with guys like Bannon. And, Peter, welcome back. First of all, I have to say, in your reaction to the subpoena, I'll start with that, because here's the New York Post headline from Monday. Trump aide Navarro refuses to comply with House subpoena in COVID probe. I thought it's similar to Bannon, in that I don't think people fully understand what your objections are to this. And if they're to be fair, which I know the media is not, your objection to this is not just outright defiance, is it? It's something more.
There's a very important principle known as executive privilege. It goes back to our very first president, George Washington, and it's built around the concept that in order for a president to make effective decisions, he has to have people around him who can be assured of confidentiality in expressing their opinions. I mean, that's the core and essence of executive privilege. And over our long history in this republic, the case law has strongly supported that privilege. And so I'm taking a principled stand based on the fact that President Trump has clearly asserted executive privilege publicly in this case. And the public good test is clearly fails here, because this is simply a Democrat partisan committee intent on a witch hunt to gin up a case that would blame President Trump in some way for mismanaging the pandemic. And I find it ironic that this committee is pursuing me for a couple of reasons. I mean, first of all, as you read in the In Trump Type book, I mean, I literally was the guy in the White House, the first guy who not only recognized the dangers of the pandemic besides the president, but I was the guy in February writing a dozen memos that jump-started the vaccines, the therapeutics. I was the guy who got us the PPE. I mean, and it's like, you know, why, you know, it's kind of interesting that they would target me. But the other thing, Chris, it's so friggin' ironic here. It's like, we're sitting here right now, and the Biden regime has now a higher death count than the Trump administration ever had. Okay, more people have died of the China virus under Joe Biden's watch than did under Donald Trump. And we gave Biden a vaccine, okay? In fact, we gave him a suite of vaccines. We gave him plenty of therapeutics. We gave him stockpiles. So that's the principle underlying this, that you don't broach the privilege. And I look, once the president asserts the privilege, I can't waive the privilege. I can't waive the privilege.
Yes.
Only the president can waive the privilege. So
to be to be clear, Peter, two things. Number one, this subpoena is based on COVID response. It has nothing to do. You're not involved in any way with conversations about January 6th, right?
That is correct. And in Chapter 21 in the In Trump Time book basically fully exonerates both Bannon and the president of any complicity in stirring up any kind of violence, because, you know, as the Chapter 21 in Trump Time starts, it's like on a cold, raw and windy day as the sun rose over Washington, D.C., the last three people on God's good earth who wanted to see violence erupt were Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and myself. And the reason is we had this thing called the Green Bay Sweep, you know, it was the political equivalent of the famous football play. Designed to remand the votes back to the battleground states for 10 days to have them look at what was, in our view, then obvious fraud and election irregularities. And what we view now is, yeah, that's exactly what happened. Fact. So, no, I'm not. This is a separate matter from the January 6th thing. And, you know, Meadows, the chief of staff, the fourth chief of staff I had to serve under, and they were all were a pain in the ass. he I mean, look, I'm telling you, don't get me started on that. And it's in the book. You know, he made a fundamental, it's a typical cowardly Meadows. You know, the guy always thought he could go up to the hill and be the master of the universe up there. And, you know, he goes up there, tries to negotiate, and he realizes they got him in a corner. And so then he backs off, and now he's trying to take a principal stand. It's like stupid, you know, it's like, no.
You know, I'm interested in this, Peter, that yesterday Liz Cheney, this odious creature whose, you know, motives, I think we're beginning to understand are more institutional preservation than anything else. And what is and grudge as a grudge, I guess, on behalf of dad or whatever motivates her.
Big
but anyway,
grudge.
Yeah.
Big grudge.
But
no, it's a big grudge.
She starts reading.
I've seen that firsthand.
Yeah. And she starts reading this text exchange back and forth between Fox News hosts like Sean and Laura and Kilmeade with Meadows. And it's, I guess, supposed to make, I don't know who it's supposed to make look bad, because Laura, Brian, and Sean are all texting Mark Meadows saying, you need to get Trump on TV. You got to stop this. This is bad. It's going to make the whole 4 years look bad. You know, we don't want anybody killed. I don't know what invoking that was supposed to do on Monday. Do you? What was the goal of that exactly?
Of what? I'm not clear.
Exposing those texts, because CNN is running with it like it's a big scandal that Fox News hosts were texting Meadows.
Yeah,
I don't get it.
I've been kind of puzzled by that. I mean, like Meadows wanting to have the National Guard up there to make sure nobody got hurt. And is that a big scandal? I don't know. I mean,
It's like, but the point is, he never should have gone there because he should have respected the privilege. It was not Mark's right to waive the privilege, right? And he did, and he should have known better. But I mean, the
you mean in handing those over and handing those texts over? You mean
what he look what the executive privilege? Let me restate this: that it's kind of the anchor of effective decision making.
Yeah.
In a White House dating back to George Washington, Thomas Jefferson. There's cases all the way along involving famous presidents. And, you know, the definitive case in the matter is Nixon, but there's others there. And look, it's like what Meadows should have done is what I'm doing, which is to respect the privilege and understand it's not my or his ability to waive the privilege. It's the president's privilege, not mine. Okay. And I just know Mark. I mean, he always thought he could go up to the Hill and dominate up there. And every time he came back to the White House, he had his ass handed to him. I mean, I watched this for 8 months. You know, he came along in March of 2020 and he just never got anything done up there. He just thought he could do it again. And, like, shame on him. I mean, it's just he blew it. And he undermines my position. He undermines Bannon's positioning. And most importantly, he undermines executive privilege in the president.
Peter, Peter Navarro is a former White House advisor, by the way. I just wanted to reset. And your book, incidentally, if people want to read all about this in full detail, they can pick it up in Trump Time, a Journal of America's Plague Year. Just to put a bow on this, Peter, when we talk about things like, and I know you don't, we've talked to you about this before, and I know until we rectify the situation with the election of 2020, you're not interested in talking about 2024, but I only bring up one in particular person, because I don't know that I've talked too much with you about Mike Pence. And, you know, amongst Trump voters, there's a lot of anger at Pence for feeling he didn't do enough, and Pence continues to assert that there was really nothing more he could have done. I don't know that I've talked to you about Pence particularly. What is your judgment historically on Mike Pence?
Actually, interestingly enough, the full story is in the In Trump Time book in chapter 21, because I had a great relationship with Mike. There's a funny story in the In Trump Time book about how I went into the Oval Office one day after a particularly vicious tilt with Jake Tapper on Sunday TV and things like that. And Mike did a beautiful spot on impression of me, like with my hand gesture. I mean, it was warm and funny and I mean, it was cool. Right. But here is the problem. It's like midway through the 4 years, Mike made a really fatal mistake for his political future. He hired this guy, Mark Short, as his chief of staff. Now, I described Mark Short as Iago and Othello in the In Trump Time book because what Short does for his own Shakespearean peculiar ends is he manipulates Pence on behalf of the Koch network, which is virulently anti-Trump. The Koch brothers, the Koch network is that dark money that goes into a lot of conservative causes and candidates, but it's the rhino conservatives who don't support the transformational aspects of the Trump agenda, like secure borders and fair trade, right? So the Koch guy gets in there and begins walling off Mike very effectively. You couldn't get to Mike anymore. I had walk-in privileges before Short get there, and after he got there, I just couldn't see Mike at all or brief him on anything. And so what Pence does in chapter 21 of the book, he basically betrays the president in two ways. The first thing he does is he has Short and this general counsel, Greg Jacob, another villain in the In Trump Time book, draft up a bogus legal opinion that's going to justify Pence's betrayal of the president. And the real betrayal was the fact that they never shared that document either with the president or the White House chief of counsel before they dropped it publicly. And that was wrong. That was morally, ethically, politically, legally, constitutionally wrong. If you're vice president in the White House and you're writing a legal opinion, you damn well share that with the president. You damn well let the White House counsel look at it. They did not do that. And so it was the violence that allowed Pence to abort the Green Bay Packers sweep mission, because it all started right. I mean, it's like Gosard and Cruz challenged the Arizona vote. Pence says, yeah, okay, we're going to send that to a committee here to discuss. And everything was going fine. And then all hell breaks loose on Capitol Hill. So Pence, in my judgment, his political career is over. I mean, there's no way that man wins a Republican primary for president. The party now is the party of Trump, and the Trump base has repudiated him.
So you think, disowned him. I hate to relitigate this, because I know you, first of all, you write about it. I know you've talked about it ad nauseum, but just for the record, yeah, one more time, Pence, you do feel then Pence ultimately could have been instrumental in not certifying that vote if he'd wanted to. He consistently says, the president and I just disagree on my constitutional role there. And he maintains he never had a constitutional role in holding that certification up. And you just fundamentally disagree with that.
Yes, I do. Because I've read his legal brief. I've read briefs on the other side. Even though I'm an economist, I'm actually got articles published in law journals, because I did a lot in the regulatory law. I know my way around case law, right? And he got bad advice from a Koch network, and he became a pawn and puppet in their game. I mean, Mike, what does Mike know about the law? He knows squat. He doesn't know anything about the law. He was told by Mark Short, a Koch brothers emissary, and Greg Jacob, a Rhino Republican, that this is how the law reads. And look, you know, at a minimum, it's a debatable, disputable issue. And on that alone, you should at least let the White House legal counsel and the president see your work.
Could you walk me through, Peter, just because I want to be clear, could you walk me through if Pence had held and challenged the certification the way you would have liked, could you walk me through where we'd be instead?
Yes. Well, again, the Chapter 21 in the In Trump Time book is very clear and gives you the roadmap. The goal was simple. We had six battleground states, Arizona, Georgia, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Nevada, where there was likely fraud and irregularities. Under the Constitution and established law, congressmen and senators could challenge those votes before certification, which would first require 2 hours per chamber per state of discussion. And that would be 24 hours of publicly televised hearings. Our view was those hearings would finally allow us to get to the American public directly, because we were being effectively shadow banned and censored by the print media and the social media on the whole issue. Pence, all we wanted, we didn't expect Pence to overturn the election or anything. All we wanted was for him, under his authority, to simply send that back to the states for 10 days to look prior to certification to see if there were problems, and effectively give the states enough time to decide whether they wanted to certify again. Now, what we
because
expected,
to be fair, to be clear about this, historically accurate, it's true that leadership in, for instance, Pennsylvania, I know the Pennsylvania legislature said they requested formally of Pence, don't certify this thing. We have problems here,
correct.
Didn't they? Yeah,
correct. Yeah, and to play the Green Bay Packers sweep scenario out, we fully expected that in the clear light of day that a number of the states would choose on second review, like on the instant replay kind of, that not to certify. Pennsylvania, Arizona certainly, probably Wisconsin, and likely Georgia. And we now know, based on a lot of the analysis I've done and the facts that have come up yet, yeah, the thing was stolen, right? So what would have happened was, okay, go back to the states for 10 days. You would have seen states not certify the election. And at that point, the election would have been determined by the House of Representatives rather than by the Electoral College.
Okay.
And under the numbers there, Trump would be president. You know, and the underlying, Chris, for your listeners here, what's really important to understand is that I have proved beyond any shadow of doubt in the In Trump Time book that the election was, in fact, stolen. And based on the evidence we're getting in every day from Arizona, let me just do a quick math for you to show you what I mean so people don't think I'm full of bull here. Arizona was a state that was won allegedly by Biden by less than 12,000 votes, okay? A forensic audit and canvas out there has determined, among other things, that at least 50,000 ghost voters voted absentee in Arizona from Maricopa County. Fact two. Fact three, the absentee ballots went at a minimum 2-1 to Biden. So if you take those 50,000 ghost voters and rule them invalid, that's a 17,000 vote swing, which is enough to swing the election.
This conversation with Peter Navarro, the former assistant to President Donald Trump, author of the book In Trump Time, A Journal of America's Plague Year. We continue to swim around in this for a little bit because I'd never really talked it out from somebody's inside perspective on how they saw January 6th and that day, how they got there, how they got the math, what they thought Pence's role in it should be. It was an extensive conversation. He's on the California coast, so we had to have it late in the day yesterday. We spent about a half an hour together, so the rest of this conversation today, if you're not a part of my podcast, I hope you will be. ChrisStigall.com or wherever you subscribe to podcasts. I hope you'll start listening to mine and you'll hear the rest of the Peter Navarro conversation and just great content each and every week at ChrisStigall.com. Quick break at 722 on Philadelphia's AM 990 The Answer.
Merry Christmas.
So good to be with you today. Merry Christmas. Thank you for choosing Philadelphia's AM 990 The Answer. I appreciate it. I know there are a ton of places you could be, lots of places you could be listening or watching, spending your time in the course of a morning, and that you spend it with us is never lost on us. So thank you very, very much. And always grateful to have the perspective of great guests in our community who add perspective that, you know, we don't always have here on the show, but are actually out there living the things we talk about every day. He lived it through this pandemic. He helped us talk a lot about what ultimately became two constitutional amendments that you voted on and you passed, limiting executive authority in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania going forward because the executive actions of Tom Wolf had profound impacts on his business and so many businesses like his. Dave McGrogan is who I'm talking about, CEO of Harvest Seasonal Grill and Wine Bar, owner of Barra Rosa in downtown Philadelphia, and glad to have Dave back on what continues to be, Dave, a year that every time I think we've weathered the worst of it, they throw a new curveball at us. Good morning.
Chris, good morning. Thanks for having me on. And yeah, doesn't this just seem to be going on forever, forever and ever?
Listen, I every time I feel compelled to complain, Dave, I think of you sincerely, and I think, well, I don't make my living doing what Dave does, so I don't have it that bad. I just sit in a room and bloviate. You have to run restaurants and pay people and try to survive in this unbelievable thing. And I don't know how you keep, frankly, your spirits as high as you do. This feels like a time, I'm seeing a lot of restaurateurs who have been in this game 20, 30, in one case yesterday, 50 years saying, I'm out, I quit. I'm done. Can't do it anymore. Whether it's supply chain costs, staffing, regulations, they're just getting out of longtime family businesses like yours.
Yeah, you know, it's really exhausting. And I was actually in Westchester. My corporate office is in Westchester. And I walked up and got a sandwich the other day at the local Benny's Pizza place right on Church Street in Westchester. And the owner of that place was saying how he can't get pizza boxes. He can't get 18-inch pizza boxes. He has to drive an hour to go get them, and he can only buy a two-day supply. So every couple days, he drives an hour to go buy some pizza boxes. And he's just like, I don't want to do it anymore. I'm tired of it. You know, I don't know his age, probably 62, 63, has no more desire to be in this business, but stuck in this business. And I think that so many people, too, have given up on fighting. There's no value in fighting anymore. And, you know, I think what we saw with the Supreme Court overturning the wolf mask mandate, I think what we saw with the courts blocking Biden on the vaccine mandate, I think there was some optimism there. Like, this thing was finally, the courts were finally saying, okay, life has to go on even in a pandemic, and you can't have these overreaching authority. And then Philadelphia just slams in with this mandate on vaccine mandates for restaurant guests and restaurant employees. And everybody just seems okay with it. Everybody just sort of said, okay, this is the new rule. And it's amazing to me that on one side we can have the courts stepping up and protecting our liberties and our freedoms and some rational thought here. And on the other side, Philly just seems to accept that they've given the mayor and the health secretary there just so much authority, and they just accept it.
Dave, I'm one guy, so, you know, who am I? And maybe I'm not representative of your clientele. I don't know who comes through the door in your Philadelphia location at Barra Rosa, but I will just say, given these new rules and regs from this regime in Philadelphia, if I never dine out in Philadelphia again after the new year, so be it. And if it creeps into Chester County or Bucks County or Montgomery County, okay, then I'll dine out in Lancaster County, or I'll just eat at home. Like, I don't need to go out to eat, and I know you understand that. And so it interests me that there are so many restaurateurs that are like, yay, we can't, you know, the Steven Stars of the world who just are in orbit, excited, embracing the idea of this. Maybe I'm not that important to guys like Steven Star, but I can't imagine I'm the only guy thinking this way. I'll just not go out to eat. Like, I'm not going to be held hostage about it.
You touched on 2 points. One, I've been trying to get other restaurateurs to understand that if this goes off without a hitch in Philadelphia, how do you not think that Governor Wolf's not sitting in Harrisburg trying to figure out a way to do this all across the state? Or, as you mentioned, county governments try to do this. If they figure out that somehow they have the statutory power and the police power to somehow create this and not have it overturned by the court. So if it can work in Philadelphia, then Delaware County is going to try it, and then Chester County is going to try it. And so it seems like the suburban restaurant owners are basically like, it's not happening to me, I'm not going to ruffle feathers. Or they also realize they're probably going to get a boost in sales from this. I mean, you're going to get employees out of the city. Suburban restaurant owners, there will be employees that leave the city that do not want to get vaccinated. They will come to the suburbs. And you're going to have guests just like yourself decide that they're not coming into the city. And the city is a multifaceted problem right now for restaurant owners. So we have a failing infrastructure. So a little known fact about the city of Philadelphia is there's several closed parking garages. The one near Barra Rosa is only operating on two floors because after the Miami condo collapse, they inspected all these parking garages. So I don't even have much parking near my restaurant anymore. So I've got infrastructure issues. Then I've got the crime issues of the city, which they'll ignore, but are very real. I've got people driving up and down Walnut Street, shooting bottle rockets out of their car windows. It's like Mad Max or like some like Gotham before Batman some days in that city. Right.
Unbelievable.
And then all of a sudden now you throw in the vaccine thing, and it's Philadelphia City Council. I've testified in front of them before about paid sick leave and other things. And they always talk about San Francisco, and then they talk about New York, and they forget that in many aspects, Philadelphia is closer to Detroit than it is San Francisco or New York. We're the poorest big city, and we have the highest crime rate. Stop telling people that we're San Francisco and we're surrounded by people that all make millions of dollars a year. If you look at the average income around San Francisco versus Philadelphia, they're not anywhere similar, but they enforce laws as if we're this affluent big city that everybody wants to go to. You don't have to go to Philadelphia.
Dave, I am so glad you said, I just said this yesterday, and I think maybe people think I make it up, but I just said Philadelphia is not New York. Philadelphia is not, you're right, San Francisco. And there's this attitude of, we can weather anything. We're Philadelphia. This is not sustainable, the environment they've created with business.
No, I can tell you this. I was up in New York, I don't know, 2 months ago and stayed at Bryant Park. And so you're wedged in between Park Avenue and Times Square. Left dinner down in the Village, and I got to tell you, Soho, the Village, felt pretty normal. They checked your vax cards, but otherwise, people were living. In the neighborhood areas, people were out and about. 10 o'clock, come back from dinner. Oh, we'll get dropped off at the hotel. We're right across from Bryant Park, and we'll walk either direction and go get an after-dinner drink. Everything was closed. We could not find a place to get a glass of wine or a beer at 10:15 in New York on a Friday in that tourist district. Because there were no tourists. And the office building behind us, we could look out our window and see the office building from the hotel. 10 stories of just empty office space with just some dim lights on the whole time. And New York is a place people actually want to go to see Broadway and shows and do all this. Philadelphia is not very competitive. And from my house in Chester Springs, I can get to New York in 2 hours. On a Friday night, it takes me an hour and 20 minutes to get into Philadelphia. So what am I going to choose? I'd rather choose New York, right, if I have the same rules in place.
Is there a day you see that Barra Rosa just closes its doors, given the trajectory? I mean, or will you hang with this? I'm sorry to talk about the fatality of a property, but, I mean, how long do you tolerate it?
It's so funny because, I have enough days in this year for Florida to be a Florida resident. I'll definitely have enough days in next year. And, you know, business has really come back well at Harvest. We're really doing some great things. We're going to open a new Harvest in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. And that was set up before COVID. And then we re-brought that up, you know, so that was something before COVID we had been negotiating. So I have to tell you, there was a little bit of optimism and things were getting better. And then this thing comes along. And on top of just the frustration about the Philadelphia vaccine mandate, is the way that nobody's fighting it. There's just no fight left anymore, or everybody's decided that Philadelphia functions one way, so just let it. And I literally...
Or if I may, Dave, even worse, some of your colleagues seem to be gleefully embracing it, which is most concerning to me. Do they mean it?
I think they do. And if you circle back on the, what about Barra Rosa? It's a restaurant that means something to me because a partner that I had in that restaurant, a longtime partner, passed away, not of COVID. He was in his 80s. But, it was something he asked me to do. I did it. It was his property. Just a meaningful place to me in that respect. But if somebody offered me a check tomorrow for that restaurant and I knew the employees were going to be okay and taken care of, I would do it because I don't have any need to make, I already do all these different things to function in Philadelphia than I have to in the burbs. Now I have to do it again, right? There's all these different laws just across the line. And to bring up the way that other restaurateurs have responded, it's great. Everybody can have their opinion. Everybody can do it. But I just don't understand when you see the case count in New York, when you see the case count in California, and then you see the case count in Florida, why you think it works, because it doesn't. I just had my one manager out from Barra Rosa for 10 days, double vaxxed, and he got COVID. Double vaxxed, and he got COVID. I just had a server go out, double vaxxed, and he got COVID. So I don't understand. It'd be totally different if this vaccine was like the polio vaccine, where all of a sudden it was just like, you're not getting it, you're not spreading it. My employees with COVID, with the vaccine are still getting it, and they're still spreading it to each other. So they act as if this is a fix. And it just, yes, I have no problem saying that vaccinated people are less likely to die and less likely to go to the hospital. I can accept that argument, and I don't want to argue it. I can live with that. But what I can tell you is it doesn't stop the spread within a restaurant. You know, when we've had cases pop up, it's happening just as much in a vaccinated or a non-vaccinated person. So that's why I don't understand this acceptance, because I guarantee you, all of these restaurateurs saying that have had COVID outbreaks among their vaccinated team members. They absolutely have.
So let's also, Dave McGrogan, by the way, Dave McGrogan, CEO of Harvest Seasonal Grill and Wine Bar, owner of Bar Rosa in Center City, Philadelphia. Not to mention, now this vax mandate, you're also talking about staffing issues. This is a real-time problem. I'm imagining the people that you can get to come to work now asking for papers at the door, you know, of patrons who want to come in and eat. What a nightmarish thing. You can barely keep staff, and the staff you can keep on, they now get to be pseudo health inspectors in your restaurant.
There's an issue they don't want to talk about here, which is, number one, the unfair competitive advantage, or there's no protection of equal rights here. So if my line cook decides that he doesn't want to be vaccinated because of a religious issue, because of a societal issue, because he doesn't trust medicine, because he had an adverse reaction to the first dose, whatever it happens to be, that guy can now leave Barra Rosa, walk two blocks away to the new Target over there, and get a job at Target. He doesn't have to stay in the restaurant industry. And the restaurant industry is the only one with this vax mandate. So I have a big issue with that. That is where I don't understand how a restaurateur, regardless of their feelings politically or about the vaccine, if you're the furthest left restaurateur on the planet, how do you think that's fair that you could lose people? And then the other issue is, think about the guy that comes in the morning and cleans up your building. He comes in, he mops, he vacuums, he dusts everything, whatever it happens to be. That guy has to be vaccinated. He's not interacting with another soul. He's not interacting with a guest. That cleaner has to be vaccinated. He doesn't have to be vaccinated to go clean a gym. He doesn't have to be vaccinated to even go clean a hospital in Philadelphia. And that guy has to be vaccinated. So you're going to see a couple of things happen that's already happened. You're going to see more people leave our industry for good because they're tired of it. So I have bartenders that have become IT people. I have, you know, cooks that have gone on to work at Amazon, you name it. I've seen all that. They're permanently out of the industry. So you're going to have more Philadelphia people leave the industry permanently. And then Philadelphia always makes the stupid mistake of thinking that somehow they're so important that jobs will not go to Cherry Hill, Conshohocken, King of Prussia, or Westchester. There is no great reason to come into Philadelphia. Why? To pay for parking, to pay a city wage tax, to get carjacked, to get mugged when you're waiting for the bus? Are these all the reasons that you want to work in Philadelphia? Or, oh, you mean I can work in the suburbs and make the same amount of money and not have this payroll, this additional tax on my income, or work in a safer environment? And that's what Philadelphia fails to understand. So I don't understand how the restaurateurs aren't bringing up this point, that you're making it more difficult for just one employee. And then just from a constitutional viewpoint, the fact that Biden couldn't pass this mandate vaccinating everybody with over 100 employees, but now Philadelphia can pass a mandate saying everybody in hospitality and event space has to be vaccinated. It's just insane to me that everybody's laying down and taking it.
Do you think, Dave, and this is always dangerous because how can you ever get into their heads, but I'm always curious to know the answer why, answer to the question why. Why do this? Why would they do this? And said another way, if you sat me down and you said, Chris, how can we creatively destroy small business? How can we crush restaurateurs like Dave McGrogan? You have any thoughts? You're the mayor of Philadelphia. You have any ideas? This would be a really good idea, you know, in an answer to that question. It feels, I will just say, on your behalf, this feels almost purposefully destructive. Like there's a target on your back, and people like you, they either want to wipe out, they want to take down a peg, they want to punish. And to what end, I don't know. That's the one thing I struggle with. Like, what would this leave in its wake? I don't know their goal, but it feels very purposeful.
You know, you can go down so many rabbit holes on this, right, and conspiracy theories and big agendas and all this stuff. I think it's funny, I posted something and somebody commented, watch RoboCop. This is the theme. This is the story behind the original RoboCop, where they destroy the city and then go in and buy up all the real estate, right, to redo the city. And literally, it almost feels like, okay, let's let crime run rampant. And while we're not charging fines or making court dates for small drug possessions, for petty theft, for you can walk into a Target and steal $200-$300 a day and nobody's going to bother you, you know, all these things. And then to swing back on the small business community and say, if we find one person in your building that's not vaccinated, one, it's a $2,000 fine. So let's let the guy drive his ATV. 10 guys drive their ATVs in circles around the street and grab people's purses. And let's not chase them, because if we chase them, then that upsets a certain base. So we can't chase them because that would be racist or whatever it would be. But what we're going to do is that little pizza shop guy, if one of his staff members isn't vaccinated, he's got to pay a $2,000 a day fine. This is just insanity. And what is the goal? I have a good friend, a business partner, who's very intelligent. He goes, the objective is to please the base at any cost. And by picking on restaurants, they're probably going to be able to do it. And they can say, look, we did something. COVID cases are skyrocketing. So what did we do? We forced vaccine mandates on all hospitality employees, and we forced vaccine mandates on all hospitality guests. You know what? If there was some scientific data that showed that reduced COVID spread by 95%, 80%, 50%, I'd be interested in having that discussion. It's not going to stop the spread at all. It will not reduce COVID hospitalizations. It will not reduce the COVID spread one bit. But it's this button that they can do because they have so much power over it. And Wolf did the same thing. Wolf knew that he could hurt restaurants because of the LCB. He knew it, so he did it. So it's the one lever he can pull. They couldn't have said, oh, we're going to make this a requirement of all the grocery stores, because the grocery store unions would have said no. Right.
So, that's it. It feels like I do wonder if the Dave McGrogans of Philadelphia and of Pennsylvania generally, I wonder if Democrats really view you as problematic. Yeah, you're independent. You're in a revenue stream. You pay a lot of other people who make them independent. You're kind of one of the last frontiermen out there, frontiersmen and women. You know, people that are in your industry are sort of unique in that, there is no unionization. You're very much your kind of own islands. And it seems like government likes to target you guys the most of just about everybody in the private sector I see. Now, there might be others listening to me that would disagree with that sentiment, but I feel like the restaurant hospitality industry seems to be the one politicians hammer the most.
No, you're correct.
When it's politically convenient.
You're correct, and I could actually take you from Perez as Labor Secretary under Obama started with what they really wanted to do was get servers paid on a paycheck and servers not collecting tips anymore. So there was a push for this, and servers don't want to lose the tip credit, by the way. Democrats won't tell you that, but I have servers that make $20, $30 an hour. Do you think they want to make $14 an hour? No, they make $20, $30 an hour and work a five-hour shift, right? So it started a lot with Obama administration, with Perez and some of the changes to labor laws and 80-20 labor rules and all kinds of things. When we were shut down, I was on a Zoom call with Katie Muth, my state senator, and she goes, well, I'm not real comfortable with letting restaurants reopen until you pay a living wage. And I said, wait a minute. What you're telling me is I had to close for 2 weeks to flatten the curve, but I can reopen once you in Pennsylvania address your minimum wage issue, which, by the way, there's not any employee in any restaurant earning $7 an hour. I can tell you that 100%. There's not a restaurant in this state paying $7 an hour. So the wages rose under Trump because unemployment was so low. My average kitchen wage went from 12 to 15 an hour during Trump, not during Biden. It happened because I couldn't hire anybody. It was a natural economic thing that occurred under the Trump administration. So Katie Muth then decided that the way for her agenda to come across was to keep me closed longer. And then eventually we would cave and maybe the Republicans would vote to increase minimum wage. That was literally the conversation that happened. So yes, it's definitely an agenda where that what they would like to see is servers not get a tip credit anymore and servers get $15 an hour. So I have servers that make $40,000, $50,000 a year working 4 days a week so they can spend time with their family. Now that server is going to make $20,000 a year because the government's helping them. Mm-hmm. And that's where we are.
Dave, I'll let you run on this just because I know, you know, you also have hard costs to fix to operating a restaurant. Jen Psaki yesterday, the White House press secretary, talking about the cost of meat. I mean, just serving food, you know, your costs are going up. We all understand that. This has got to be one of the most absurd things that I have ever heard anyone say at the White House podium. And because you deal in purchasing food to serve to your customers, I wanted you to respond. Take a listen.
There are several progressive groups and lawmakers who are increasingly vocalizing the idea that inflation, high inflation, is being driven by corporate greed, including companies with high profits, some of whom have met at the White House with the president in recent months. Does the president endorse that idea? Does he think that corporate greed is the big driver of inflation right now?
Well, I think that the president thinks the way people across the country, American families, digest inflation is by price increases. And if you look at industry to industry, it's a little different. So, for example, the president, the secretary of agriculture have both spoken to what we've seen as the greed of meat conglomerates. That is an area where people go to the grocery store and they're trying to buy a pound of meat, 2 pounds of meat, 10 pounds of meat. It is the prices are higher. That is, in his view, and the view of our Secretary of Agriculture, because of, you could call it corporate greed, sure. You could call it jacking up prices during a pandemic. There are other areas where we've seen increases because of supply chain issues, and we're seeing those increases around the world as it relates to gas prices, oil supply, and things along those lines. So I
That's enough. So Dave McGrogan, Big Meat. I don't think I've ever heard that one before. The perils of Big Meat out there turning the screws.
So what
is that your reality?
Yeah. So what is Big Meat dealing with? They're dealing with the same crisis we're all dealing with. They're dealing with supply chain issues. You know, they're dealing with fuel cost issues. They're dealing with labor cost issues. Our hourly rate is up 17% an hour versus 2019. So we've dealt, okay, with a dramatic increase in labor costs. They're dealing with a shortage on labor. So now they got to pay overtime for somebody to process the meat. So all things being equal, businesses would like to be able to have lower cost, higher volume, and more efficient operations to be able to generate their profit, right? But what am I getting charged with in the restaurant industry? I'm getting charged right now with higher utility costs. So now it costs me more to heat my building, cook my food, have the electricity, all those types of things. So it's costing me more just on that aspect, right? Then it's costing me more to get my food delivered. I'm paying fuel surcharges. So I'm just paying cash on top of the product cost. Then I'm paying for the product at a higher rate, right? And now I'm paying more. And this is the beauty of increasing salaries, which they always forget. So the salad prep person, let's say, is your less experienced person in a restaurant, your less experienced line person. That salad person that used to make $13 an hour is now making $16. Well, the grill guy that's cooking your very expensive steaks and has 10 years of grill experience and is very experienced goes, wait a minute. I got 10 years on a grill. I know how to cook a filet mignon very well without ruining it for the guest and ruining it for you and your food costs and delivering a great product. Why am I making the same as the person that assembles a salad? So now that guy makes 22 an hour to keep him. My pizza guy, Bar Rosa, now makes $21 an hour. $21 an hour. Teachers make less than $29 an hour. Right. He's a great pizza guy. Okay.
Dave McGrogan.
And I don't want to lose him.
This is, I want to keep this conversation going. We learn so much from a practical standpoint on the ground of actually doing this and talking about the math and real numbers, not the stupid political jargon. And I'm so grateful for your perspective. Can we have you back?
Yeah, absolutely, Chris. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Dave.
And
hang in
and
there.
Merry Christmas,
and Merry Christmas to you if we don't talk before. Thanks, Dave. We'll talk again soon. CEO of Harvest Seasonal Grill and Wine Bar, Barrow Rose at downtown Philadelphia, Dave McGrogan. I don't know how they do it. I don't. I hope you'll check out the podcast today. We've got a good one. A lot of you have already responded to our conversation with Peter Navarro. There's plenty more. So if you don't check out the podcast, this would be a good week to do it. There's a lot of great stuff on there, as a matter of fact. I'll just leave it at that. Lots to listen to. If not now, maybe over the Christmas break if you have some time. Brad Lanning,
this
who wants to take on Brian
Fitzpatrick, coming up. Philadelphia's AM 990. The Answer. A Salem Media Group station on the NASDAQ at SALM. For more than a decade, he's been Philadelphia's destination for news, opinion, and passion.
Hey, your show is awesome.
Hi, good morning. Love you. Love your staff. Thank you so much. God bless y'all.
Love you and Fans Daddy and the show.
You guys are doing a fantastic job. Thank you very much, Chris.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer, and 990theanswer.com.
So there were 13 Republicans, as you remember, who voted in the affirmative. Liz Cheney being one of them. Adam Kinzinger being one of them. You know, those never-Trump Republicans that we know so well. Household names now, really. Another one of those 13 Republicans who voted in the affirmative to continue to spend and spend and spend this country into oblivion was Brian Fitzpatrick. Now, I know that you guys in the 1st Congressional District out there in the Bucks County and small parts of Montgomery County, you understand this better than anybody. And I'm of two minds about it. Sometimes it's explained to me that, hey, listen, better to have a Republican you agree with 70% of the time than a Democrat who never votes the way you want. That's how it's explained to me sometimes by GOP establishment types. Those of you who are conservatives, you blow your stack, and I understand why, when somebody like Brian Fitzpatrick sides with 12 other Republicans and makes a spending bill happen in the middle of inflation that should not have happened. And had they all held the line, those 13 Republicans, there were six Democrats who voted against that bill, that would not have been a that wouldn't have passed the House. It would have failed. So said another way, when it really, really mattered, Brian Fitzpatrick helped Nancy Pelosi pass an extraordinary spending bill that continues to drive inflation. And all in the done under the auspices of infrastructure. So this makes a lot of you in this audience very, very angry. And I hear about it. And I know, and I've been monitoring and watching the Fitzpatrick family name in Congress all the years that I've done a show in Philadelphia. And again, I hear both sides of this every time we talk about the Fitzpatrick family. I hear it said, well, listen, would you rather have a 70% Republican than none at all? And then I hear some, well, what's the difference? Shouldn't we just have a Democrat if that's the way he's going to vote anyway? So what does a guy like Brad Lanning think? He is a Republican candidate for Congress. He's decided to run against Brian Fitzpatrick in the primary. BradLanningForCongress.com is the website. That's LANNING, BradLanningForCongress.com, and joins us now. Mr. Lanning, welcome to the show. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
So what of that? That conventional wisdom that holds, hey, listen, a Republican voting 70% of the time with you is better than no Republican at all. How do you answer that?
Yeah, so I think that obviously when you're in Congress and you're working with both Democrats and Republicans, there are going to be some compromises that are to be made. However, with Brian, on some of the big fundamental economic and social issues, I wouldn't call them small compromises. When you look at the not just the infrastructure bill, but the $15 minimum wage, the Paris Climate Agreement, the Equality Act, just to give you some examples, these are not small compromises, but really dramatic compromises that hurt the American middle class. And they're very big government. And I would say they align more with the radical fringes, the radical left fringes of the Democratic Party. And I would certainly not call them moderate, center left, center right.
The Pennsylvania First is an interesting district, to say the least, because in my view, there are huge swaths of it, huge swaths. I don't know if it's most, I don't know if it's half, maybe you can quantify it, that strike me as getting increasingly more conservative, redder, more deeply red, not more left of center. That's my impression, but I don't live there. You do. You tell me.
I share that impression. I think it's getting more conservative. And I think when you look at what Biden is doing and the direction that the Democratic Party is going, I think a lot of family-oriented independents and even those who might be, you know, identify as Democrat in the past are becoming increasingly conservative. And they're looking for people that are going to push back because they're scared for what they're seeing in their schools. They're scared when they go to the gas pump or they see the prices at the grocery store. So I would agree with that assessment. I think it is becoming more increasingly conservative.
What of this idea that a guy like Trump doesn't play there, but a, if you want to call it Glenn Youngkin-style candidacy could? So Trump may not be able to come in there and rally people to his side or a candidate of his choice's side, but
a Republican who runs the right campaign can sell conservatism based on those issues that you were just talking about. Where do you come down on somebody like Trump in particular? That always seems to be sort of the metric these days.
Yeah, so the wonderful thing about the America First governing philosophy is it really transcends any individual, including Trump, although he deserves the majority of the credit for really directing the Republican Party in a direction that is centered on people-centered policy. What's best for the middle-class Americans, not the corporate lobbyists or special interest groups or even international activists in some instances. So I think focusing on policies that actually benefit the middle class, small businesses, I think that if we stick to that message, which we should, because ultimately the whole job of government is to represent the people, not to, you know, share how aligned you are with any particular individual. So I think if you just stick to that message, which I think people are hungry to hear, I think that, you could really have a strong chance of appealing to not just Republicans, but independents and moderate, especially family-oriented Democrats, the more Kennedy-type Democrats.
The demographics, particularly in Bucks County, have always interested me in that, I've always understood it that New Yorkers will often, this was pre-COVID, of course, now. The conventional wisdom always held that you had a lot of people that worked in New York that would literally make the commute every day out of Bucks County, but people moved south because they found Bucks County to be maybe more inexpensive, more hospitable, yards and room for the kids to play and not that terrible a commute to New York. With COVID, though, it became less a, less a transitory thing. It wasn't, people weren't traveling as much for work. It became home base. And so I guess over the last couple of years of COVID, have you seen the dynamics shift in Bucks County? This notion that you've got a lot of sort of, if you want, I don't mean to disparage them, but, let's call it what it is. A lot of northern interlopers coming into Bucks County. It doesn't seem like that influence is as prevalent or something. I can't really put my finger on it. I don't know if it makes sense what I'm saying.
So are you speaking to like the, the lack, there are not as much influence coming from the big city, at least New York. Is that what you're saying?
It's right. Or the big cities don't seem to have the impact that they were prior to COVID. I don't know. I don't know if that's just my perception.
It could be because, when a lot of people that worked in New York City, either they're not there and they're not enmeshed into the culture in some of these cities, and they were able to, detach themselves from that influence, and that could definitely change. But I think also a lot of commuters and people that worked in the cities, I think, are scared to go back because the crime has risen so much in these cities. And these Democratic policies that have been implemented and to such an extreme level, I think you're seeing the manifestations of that. And I think that is one of the factors that is pushing people toward being more conservative. So I think that could be a factor as well. They don't want to go back to the cities.
Right.
And they don't want those policies where they live.
Brad Lanning is with us. He's a Republican candidate for Congress. He will challenge Brian Fitzpatrick in the primaries, who is currently representative there of the 1st Congressional District of Pennsylvania. Your background, Brad, I haven't really asked much about that. What are your professional and political bona fides, or is this your first run?
This is my first run, so I'm a political outsider. I spent most of my professional career in working with small businesses or in small business. I've worked as a consulting small businesses on how to build credit and establish credibility in the marketplace. I was a recruiter where I was an intermediary between both employee and employer, helping I was on the front lines of the labor market. I was a realtor. I've worked for small businesses, small family owned businesses. So I would say that I am a Main Street guy. I have vast experience across Main Street. I juggled getting a master's degree, being a stay-at-home dad, and being a realtor over the last 5 years specifically. So I feel like I'm uniquely qualified and I can relate to the issues that most middle-class American families deal with.
Why did you decide to run for Congress?
So I decided to run because I think our country is really spiraling into a really dark place. possibly a place of no return. And I think this is a time for Americans to rise up and push back, because we might not get that time anymore. And, you know, throughout history, freedom is something that has had to be contended for. And so I think we need patriots to stand up and contend in whatever capacity they can, whether it's the library, the school board, state, local government, Congress. And when I see folks like, you know, Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick helping to steer America down this path, you know, we have to push back. We have to get involved and try to get him out. And I think that, you know, when you see Republicans working with Democrats to steer us down a path to really bring America to its knees, you know, that motivated me as a parent to step up and get involved, because, you know, it's scary what you're seeing right now. And I have two small children, and I don't know what kind of America they're going to grow up in.
Here's the cynical, and you understand at least enough. I think you've been in this at least enough to understand the cynical point of view here politically. And it is this, and this is just party truth, and it may sound harsh, but the GOP, I can almost guarantee you, looks at Brian Fitzpatrick and thinks to themselves, he's an established known name. We can raise more money with him, and we'd rather keep, quote, a Republican in that seat than risk with somebody that people don't maybe know as well in Brad Lanning. We would, the GOP, the party, has more interest in keeping a guy like Brian Fitzpatrick in place, because the attitude is, if they don't, a Democrat and the DCCC will come in and flood the zone with a lot of money and take it from the Republicans, because Brad Lanning doesn't have a foothold that the Fitzpatrick name does. That is just, you understand that, right? Going into this, that's kind of conventional party thinking.
Sure. Yeah. And when they say that, really what they're saying is they're more concerned about power and money than they are about America. And I think that that is really doing a great disservice to this country. And they're not the only ones. I think it's happened throughout the political landscape, throughout, you know, a lot of especially modern history in America. And we have to really move away from that. And to be honest, I'm not convinced that a moderate Democrat would be more liberal than Brian Fitzpatrick. Brian Fitzpatrick has moved so far to the left that you might find a Democrat that actually ends up being more conservative than Brian Fitzpatrick. So, I mean, that is something we would have to see. Hopefully we won't have to see that, but we might find ourselves in that situation.
I admire people that decide that they're going to put themselves out there and, you know, put their professional and personal lives on hold to do it. Anytime anybody makes a decision like this, it's not taken lightly, I know. And if people want to be helpful, Brad, I guess the best way to reach out is your website, bradlanningforcongress.com, right?
Yes. Thank you very much. Yep. And you can sign up to volunteer or donate if you want to get involved. You can reach out through there as well.
bradlanningforcongress.com. Good talking to you, Brad. Good luck to you, sir.
You too, Chris. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You bet. It's 8:15. Telephone number. That'll be interesting. You guys in the 1st Congressional District, Bucks County, some of Montgomery County. This comes up every cycle. Republicans who have had just about all they can take of the Fitzpatricks and want to do something about it. And I know how the party responds to it every time. That's why I was just kind of blunt with Brad, but he knows that. I'm not telling him anything he doesn't know. The Republicans do not willingly help challengers to the Fitzpatrick throne.
No, he's pretty well insulated, for sure.
610-850-0990, the number, 610-850-0990. Linda McMahon, you know Linda McMahon, she's now chair of the board of the Center for the American Worker at the America First Policy Institute. She was the former administrator of President Trump's Small Business Administration. Wonderful insights on business. She'll be with us at 8:30 on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. Just drives me crazy, crazy.
Chris DeGaulle now. Mike Gallagher at 9 on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer.
Dr. Oz was on Hannity last night. Says Facebook is censoring him. What are you rolling your eyes in there?
Yeah, but I know his people very well. So he has time for what, two Hannity hits? He's on Fox and Friends every morning. What are we doing?
What are you saying? He won't come on the show?
I think he's worried about your line of questioning. That's what I think personally. That's just my personal, you know.
Well, why does it keep going on Fox?
Well, what we were talking about with Fitzpatrick, I don't. I don't want to get into it.
What you just heard, ladies and gentlemen, is the audible version of a punt from Fast Eddie. 610-850-0990, the number, 610-850-0990. We're eager and waiting to talk with Dr. Oz and any and all candidates who are running for federal office. We think it's important to have those conversations. And this is a robust primary, heaven knows, in Pennsylvania when it comes to the governor's race, the Senate race, congressional races where there are primary fights. Like we just talked with Brad Lanning in the Congressional First of Pennsylvania, I got an email from Bryce. Now, see, this is what I mean. This is the kind of stuff I get. Now, Bryce emailed me and he said, I can see this guy, Brad, becoming 60% Republican voter in Congress. I want the guy from New Jersey, meaning Ed Durr. He wants Trucker, Ed Durr. He wants that. Bryce says, if you don't hold deep truths in the power of freedom and shrinking government, power corrupts. I just don't hear deep conservative principles. Reagan, this is easy, Chris. Says Bryce. So Bryce is not impressed.
Uh-oh. Okay.
Now, again, this is what I mean. This is why it is a complete loser for a guy like me to sit here and tell you why I think one person over another is the Republican choice for whatever. I have made that mistake in the past. I will not do it this time. I will not. You're smart. You're sophisticated. You know better than me. Who is best suited, in your opinion, as the best conservative pick or the best Republican to go forward and challenge the Democrats. So it would be ill-advised, to put it mildly, for me to tell you yay or nay on any of these people. They're all welcome here. Some of them want to come. Some of them just won't. And I'd like to think we give everyone a fair hearing. I don't think we've been unfair to anybody. I think everybody has gotten their time. As long as they're a declared candidate, and you'll make the call. I don't know what to make of people who don't want to appear. I don't know what that says to you. I'll not fill in the blanks, but I think it's. I'll just say, and it has. I want to stress again. It is not about. The show, it's not about Eddie or me or our egos about it or anything. It really has nothing to do with that. It's the fact that this audience, I think, is not served well when people don't choose to come here and talk to you about the things that matter. And maybe they think that this audience is, I'll say broadly, I'm not talking about anyone in particular, but I do know this attitude. Mitt Romney, for instance, had this attitude in 2012. I remember this very, very well. The Mitt Romney campaign's attitude was, we don't need talk radio. Talk radio's hostile to us. Talk radio asks us tough lines of questions that we can't always answer. You were a Massachusetts governor. You supported a Obamacare light in Massachusetts. You're having a hard time explaining that. Let's just avoid it. Because you're already the Republican nominee, and you don't need to be hassled about conservative stuff. You've just got to win. And so it's not like these guys are going to tell everybody to go vote Obama on the radio. And it's not like these voters are going to vote for Obama. So all you've got to do is just hang in there. Go on the Sunday shows. Do cable news hits. Don't mess with being hassled by those talk radio people. They'll vote for you in the end. And, of course, the calculation is wrong because you still need people to trust and believe and feel passion and excitement for you and investment in you. And you need to make people feel passion and make people trust you. And when you just decide to ignore the base and just take them for granted and assume they'll show up because you've got an R behind your name, those days are gone. I saw them winnowing away during the Mitt Romney candidacy. They're long gone now. This idea that because you've got an R behind your name, people will show up and vote for you? Uh-uh. And I don't know. Like Donald Trump showed the way. He broke the mold and showed the way. And I don't know why people think they can return to this delivery of let's just play it safe and do kind of 30,000-foot view cable news and Sunday show television hits, and let's never say anything too specific. And as long as we never get too specific and keep things kind of general and kind of talk Republican-y, you get the nomination, you're a shoo-in because they're not voting for the Democrat. It's that Romney strategy. I've lived through this now a few cycles, and I'll just tell you, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. All right, 610-850-0990. Linda McMahon is the chair of the board at the Center for the America Worker. Sorry, I butchered this. The chair of the board and the Center for the American Worker is what's at the America First Policy Institute that she heads. She was the former administrator of the Small Business Administration. We're always glad to have Linda McMahon on the show because she's someone who's actually run a business at a high level. She understands what it is to actually pay people and what labor costs and fixed costs mean. And so when you have a perspective like that, you always want to welcome it in and learn from it. And so we're grateful for your time again this morning, Ms. McMahon. Hi.
Good morning, Chris. How are you? It's a pleasure to be on.
Likewise. Thank you so much, and Merry Christmas to you. I'm going to play for you one of the most absurd things I've ever heard, and it's Jen Psaki yesterday talking about inflation. And since you were the Small Business Administration's chief for Donald Trump, I just wonder if you were sitting there and you heard the White House press secretary explaining inflation this way, how you'd respond. If you don't mind, I'll play this for you. Here we go.
Okay.
There are several progressive groups and lawmakers who are increasingly vocalizing the idea that inflation, high inflation, is being driven by corporate greed, including companies with high profits, some of whom have met at the White House with the president in recent months. Does the president endorse that idea? Does he think that corporate greed is the big driver of inflation right now?
Well, I think that the president thinks the way people across the country, American families, digest inflation is by price increases. And if you look at industry to industry, it's a little different. So, for example, the president, the Secretary of Agriculture have both spoken to what we've seen as the greed of meat conglomerates. That is an area where people go to the grocery store and they're trying to buy a pound of meat, 2 pounds of meat, 10 pounds of meat. The prices are higher. That is, in his view, and the view of our Secretary of Agriculture, because of, you could call it corporate greed, sure. You could call it jacking up prices during a pandemic. There are other areas where we've seen...
So that's enough. You get the flavor of it, Ms. McMahon, and I read people on social media who embrace this right away. When costs get out of whack, it's corporate greed. And I just, you know, it's one thing for partisans out there kind of that are political neophytes to say it. It's quite another to say it from the White House podium, in my view. Your response?
Well, you know, it's pretty interesting. I always kind of break things down to common sense, Chris. And when I read about a guy named James Lawson, who has a pastry business in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, and he's saying, you know, he used to buy 100 pounds of, you know, of butter for $300 to make the pastries in his business, and now that same 100 pounds of butter costs him $450 to $475 just to make his same pastries and croissants every morning. So what he's had to do is cut back on the numbers that he's making because he just simply can't afford, you know, to buy the ingredients to produce as much product. Now, I don't think that sounds like corporate greed. That sounds like survival of business to me. And I think those are most of the kinds of stories that you will hear around the country relative to small businesses. You know, restaurateurs, they're trying to, you know, sell their lunches and dinners to customers across the country. They've had to pay more for chicken and beef and ground beef to make cheeseburgers and hamburgers with. And the cost of that beef has gone up because it costs more to get it there. From the transportation industry, the cost of energy is higher to get those products in the door. And so this is not corporate greed, though I think on the other end of high corporate profits, sometimes you might see that. But we are talking about bread and butter issues that are affecting families, you know, across our countries. I saw a report the other day that over the past 12 months, it's cost the average American family about $4,000 more, you know, for their own budgets than it was, you know, a year ago. These are real kitchen table issues, and to try to blame it on corporate greed, I think is just absolutely nonsensical.
Linda McMahon with us. She was the former administrator of the Small Business Administration. under President Trump is the employment issue in this country is something that I still don't fully have a handle on. I can't seem to get a clear and straight answer, but it's just abundantly clear anywhere you go. Now hiring signs, help wanted signs are everywhere, particularly in the retail sector, in the service industry. They just can't find physical people to come in and do the work. What is the cause of that? What's your understanding of it, Ms. McMahon?
Well, you know, it's a lot of factors that go into it. I mean, if you look at, when the pandemic hit, first started hitting around the end of 2019 in December, and then went into the early parts of 2020, and we shut the economy down. We lost the businesses. People were out of work. They were either furloughed, or had to go. If they were furloughed, oftentimes, hopefully, they could get, benefits while they were out. Then we extended the benefits and people stayed out longer than was necessary when the country started recovering from the economy. But suddenly now we've got a good economy. Let me just digress for a second. The economy was so sound before the pandemic hit. I mean, we were seeing record numbers of unemployment. Small businesses especially had the greatest the greatest feelings of optimism about how their businesses were going to grow. They were investing in them. They were hiring. They were doing all of these things. And then COVID hit. We shut down the economy. We saw all the effects of that as we started to come out of the economy, primarily because we suddenly had a good vaccine that President Trump had put on warp speed to develop. We started being able to recover from this pandemic. Now, small businesses wanted to, revive themselves. Those that could, more small businesses, were starting. And suddenly there weren't the people there, to hire because they could not work because they were being paid on extended benefits. And it's just kind of mushroomed. We now have a recovery in our economy that is allowing a lot of those workers, and this is a good thing, to shop for better jobs. And so they'll leave a job that they're in to go to a better job. And so there are a lot of employers now that are seeking to hire more and more employees. And those employees have options. And as I say, that's a good thing. But part of that is fueled, by the fact that we had extended unemployment benefits that allowed people to stay out of work for a while. So it's complicated.
It is complicated, and I know that on the higher end of the demographic spectrum, you have a lot of people that took early retirements, so I assume you've got other people that maybe were able to leave jobs and move up or move into those spots. So you're saying, and I know this is so, I mean, because I read the Bureau of Labor Statistics reports that say we just have this plethora of job openings. Do we not have enough people to fill them? And this is where you start to get into kind of an age-old Chamber of Commerce debate on immigration, right? That, because we don't have Americans that will take these jobs or fill these jobs, we're going to need labor imported from outside of the country to fill them. Do you accept that premise?
I think there is something, to that, Chris. But let's look back even to even before, President Trump was elected I remember when I was running for the Senate in the state of Connecticut, and that was 2010, 2012, both those races, and I was unsuccessful, but I was running and I was hearing from employers in the state of Connecticut that they had jobs that they couldn't fill, that they were constantly advertising, for employees. And part of that was because the labor market was changing. And we needed to reskill some of the folks that, to fill the new kinds of jobs. And so that's been going on for some time. And as our economy has really changed and rebounded, over the years, I don't think that we have skilled the employees that we now need for a lot of the jobs that we have today. I often, when I was at SBA, talked to employers in community colleges and technical schools about what did those businesses need, what kind of skills. And you had often I think the smart companies were working with the educational institutions to develop the programs for the jobs that are needed today. And as more and more technology comes in, as we see how things are changing, we need to constantly invest in that labor force, you know, to fulfill the jobs for today. Now, that's a longer term project, but we have some immediate needs, you know, today in our small businesses for those that are reopening, and they are having a very difficult time, you know, finding employees.
There are kids, and you well know this. I mean, I have a 17-year-old who is going to be entering his senior year of high school. We're having very serious conversations about all that is available to him that does not involve a four-year institution, does not involve a college degree. I mean, there are trades and professions out there that are willing to pay a kid at 18 to train him, pay him pretty well, and then, you know, I'm hearing of young 20-somethings that are making six-figure salaries out there in various fields, particularly labor fields. It's, I mean, that's real. And that is not something that when I was in college 20 years ago was conventional wisdom. The conventional wisdom was you've got to have that four-year diploma, Linda McMahon.
Well, you'll never hear me try to dissuade anyone who can afford and wants to have a college education, you know, from pursuing that, because I do think that college offers, you know, so many opportunities. But I do believe that in today's world, there are many, many jobs that are available that can get the kind of training that you were talking about. I mean, let's look at plumbers, electricians, welders, you know, the skills that we need for our day-to-day economy that does not require a four-year education. And there are many young people just like your son who might enter into these trades, and if they want to pursue higher education, they can actually then put themselves through school, or they can start their own business and have it grow and get further education along the way if they so desire. So I think that there are many ways to look at the education that we want to provide, not only for our young people like your son just graduating from high school, but also for those folks who might be closer to middle age who want to get reskilling, retraining in their own companies. Many of those companies which will pay for that reskilling and retraining. So I think we're kind of in that position of looking at our labor force and saying, okay, what do we need? And how do we really go after it? We started that, you know, really under the Trump administration of reskilling our workforce and working with companies to help provide that reskilling and training. So I just think we have such an opportunity in our country today. If we look at what we need to push forward, to develop these new skills, to provide the kind of workers that our companies need. It's an exciting time if you look at it, and I think with those eyes.
Linda McMahon is with the America First Policy Institute now. She was the former administrator of the Small Business Administration under President Trump. Always love your insights, Ms. McMahon. I hope you can come back and talk with us again.
Thank you so much, Chris. Merry Christmas to you and everyone.
Merry Christmas. Thank you very, very much. At 847, telephone number 610-850-0990. I got to tell you, we called a plumber the other day to come over and fix a couple of things because I'm worthless. And couldn't have been a nicer guy. Came over at like 7 o'clock at night. And I know that a lot of people who don't do that kind of work don't see it as particularly glamorous or desirable. But for a half-hour visit, I think he pocketed something like $350 because I needed him, and I don't know how to do it, and it was 7 o'clock at night. Now, did that interrupt his evening? And it's, you know, working on a couple of toilets, and I understand there's... But, look, you do the math on that?
Oh,
I mean,
oh, yeah.
It's pretty hard to argue with the money. It's pretty hard to argue with the dough. And there are more and more people like me out there who don't know what the hell to do without somebody like that guy who is desperately necessary. You talk about having an economy by the short hairs. You're in the catbird seat if you're in skilled labor at this time in history. You just are. Because fewer and fewer people like me know what they're doing or even want to attempt it and will happily pay whatever it takes at whatever time of day to get it fixed. I I have a very difficult time looking at a kid who's like not particularly excited about college and telling him he should ignore that pot of gold just sitting there if he can learn the basic skills of the trades. And it is a pot of gold. It's better money than any four-year degree is going to score you. Mathematically, right now, there's just no way to argue it. This is Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer.
Then one foggy Christmas Eve, Santa came to say.
Holly Madison. She was one of Hefner's three girlfriends on that show. I mean, I know he had lots of girlfriends over the years, but Hugh Hefner, the Playboy founder, you know, he lived in the mansion. And E! Did a reality show, and it followed him with his three live-in girlfriends.
The Girls Next
Holly
Door.
Holly Madison was one of them. Remember what the name of that was? I don't even remember.
Yeah, it was The Girls Next Door.
Okay, yeah. Well, Holly Madison says now that Hugh Hefner took sexually explicit pictures of her and other women that she called non-consensual.
Okay.
Does she not understand who she was living with? Is that...
Hugh Hefner was Playboy, right?
That's right. He took sexually explicit pictures of her and other women that she says were non-consensual. What part of living with two other women in a sexually promiscuous mansion lead you to believe that... Okay.
The Allied command ignored all of its men and called on Snoopy to do it again. Was the night Christmas 40 below when Snoopy...
Biden was out yesterday saying a whole lot of things, including the struggle is no longer about who gets to vote, it's about who gets to count the vote. No kidding, he said that yesterday. Well, I think that might be one of his first honest statements in a very long while. It is about who gets to count the vote, and that is why they continue to press and press and press pandemia, as Alex Berenson calls it, because keeping you scared is to
their
benefit.
This is WNTP, Philadelphia's AM 990. The Answer, a Salem Media Group station on the NASDAQ at SALM.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.